Hi, I'm Jeff Costello.
And I'm James Robertson, and this is Unbound, fiercely exploring issues that matter.
And we are very, very excited today because today is the first podcast where we have a real-life guest who is a real-life expert who knows things that we don't know. And we don't have to pretend to know them. We can actually rely on him to do that, and I'm really, really excited for it.
Yeah, Kaveh Sharruz, wonderful human being, fearless in terms of speaking on matters of human rights, especially in regards to Iran. But he's had a number of things out there as well with China and the Uyghurs. Just had an article recently that was pretty cutting towards the federal government on the Substack, The Line.
Yeah, Jen Gerson's publication. Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah.
Really good article.
And I'll give a shout out to Jen Gerson and her team. They're doing great work. I'm really enjoying some of the articles that they're coming up with. So we'll 100%. Make sure that's linked in the
definitely go and subscribe and check out The Line because they are doing great things in journalism in Canada. So before we get to our guest, what are you thinking about this week, James? Let's have a quick chat and a little catch up before we get into the interview with Kaveh.
Oh, man. Polls aren't looking good for federal conservatives. It definitely seems like if you look at some of the pundits and some of the people on social media and stuff, they're pretty harsh right now in O'Toole and the Conservative Party.
No, deserved.
Deserved. I confused about what is the message. I had a discussion with a fellow conservative, and she came up with a great line. And she said, O'Toole needs to stop Tina Turnering. And I was like, I still laugh. I'm like, what do you mean like by that? And she's like, you know, Tina Turner would go into these long dialogues while the band's playing a repetitive music in the background of a song you just want to hear. You just want to hear it. It's like, enough, be quiet. Just get to the song, get to the jam. And she's like, O'Toole's like that right now. Keeps going on about what a great guy he is. And she's like, everyone gets it. Now, tell us what your policies are, tell us what your vision is, and hammer down on that message. And I'm a little befuddled because I think there's a lot you could hold the federal conservatives to account for. And I think there is a lot of ground to provide an alternative vision.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one of those things, you know, Tristan Hopper wrote an article in the National Post about why we can't get anything built in this country, I think is what it's called. And that is really the thrust of the article there. And it's because we're too confused about what we're actually trying to do and trying to play all sides of it. And there's, you know, no way to get through some of the bureaucracy in some situations, to get through kind of activists and lobbyists in other situations. And, you know, it's like trying to, it's as hard as building a duplex in Greater Vancouver. You know, it's probably, you know, you're going to add one floor on and you're going to add, you know, update the walls and change the paint scheme. And so we need to have a, you know, 65, you know, hour long council meeting on whether the color scheme matches the surrounding environment. It's an important issue, obviously, for the neighbors who live next door.
Oppressive shadow zones, Jeff. Oppressive shadow zones.
Oh, yeah, I'm big on shadow zones. I'm really concerned about shadow zones in Greater Vancouver. But no, I mean, we complain about NIMBYism, but there is a NIMBYism of a sorts on a federal level in terms of national projects, where every single interest group, whether they're a union or they're an environmental group or they're a business group or the oil and gas lobby or, you know, whatever it is, they all want to get a seat at the table. And unfortunately, the table is only so big. As a math analogy, it's not a Hilbert's hotel with an infinite number of rooms in it. Ooh. It's you have to actually figure out who should have a voice, give them a voice, and not be afraid to turn around to people and say, sorry, your voice doesn't matter in this decision. That's tough luck. Go call your MP. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how they do that, but I think when it comes to whether it's military purchases, you know, you're looking at the boat that can't ever get built. We're still, our troops, you'd know this. I mean, troops are using handguns that are older than you in the military. I don't know if you guys got a better set of pistols when you were in the special forces, but it's, I mean, yes. Apparently there was a funny article, I think that was also in the National Post, saying, you know, the guns, the handguns, you got to be really careful because they haven't been redesigned since the 50s and they can really hurt your hand if you don't know how to shoot them properly. And it's like, is this where we're at right
is
now?
Is this real? Is this
can't
real?
Figure out how to buy handguns?
Yeah, it's fellow military members, sometimes we have this little joke when you see kind of civilians, well, I'm a civilian now, but I'll still kind of call it civvies for short, use this kind of proud moment. It's like, oh yeah, I just got this. It's military grade, you know, oh, I just got this, you know, nice piece of kit or backpack or whatever. It's military grade. And we laugh because military grade to us means the cheapest. Means like it went to the cheapest supplier, you know, yeah. And it's just made to a minimal spec, you know. Just
you could
garbage.
Be using a handgun that your grandfather used, like literally. Just,
well, anyway. You know, and going back to Tristan's article, I'd have to refamiliarize, but it starts off with obviously the vaccines because we in Canada went without a vaccine. For close to a month, I think, pretty much came to a trickle. We've been left down in the dust. I think we're 50th globally, and I don't think we're ever going to really play catch up. The government will try to spin it. Governmental leaders will spin it as much as possible to make it look pretty when it does start coming. And I expect it's going to start coming now. And it's always, you know, when you're so hungry for something, any little piece of food is going to taste like caviar, right? So we're desperate for this vaccine. They're going to offer something up, and it's not going to be that great compared to other countries, but we're going to be so happy to have it. And it's been a good news story for government.
Well, he starts there. I mean, credit to Justin Trudeau where it's due. He said that we would be vaccinated theoretically by September, and when he said that, it was looking unlikely. I think it is looking more likely now. I'm not going to count my chickens before they've hatched,
yep.
But credit to him for at least picking a date and giving an accurate kind of depiction of what that probably was. I still think that the whole process and a big problem of the federal government as well as previous federal governments under Stephen Harper is there's just no transparency. There's just no understanding of how they came up with the decisions or why, you know, certain manufacturers were picked and certain ones weren't and how the deals got done. And I don't think, you know, I think everybody's understanding that it's a crisis, but I think that everybody should, you know, that should almost give you the power as a leader to say, these are the steps I took. They're the best ones I made under the situation. You can criticize them all you want, but let me lay out exactly how this panned out and not try to PR the whole thing through your ministers and through your low-level MPs, which is what they're always doing. So,
you raise a good point about Trudeau in terms of the timeline. And it's for him to meet it, and I suspect we will meet it. But that there was more to that article, and the shipbuilding program being one, which is an embarrassment. I think we're looking at replacements for our frigates not until probably close to 2050, which is absolutely ridiculous. Those things were supposed to be starting to be replaced much sooner.
Well, it's exactly like I said. Like you read his article, and it's like it's because it's a jobs program. It's not just building military stuff, and that's one of the things where everybody has their hand out or has their say of like, well, we need to build the guns in Nova Scotia, we need to build the body of the boat in Victoria, and we need to. It's just like, why are we doing this? Like, it's just not the way to procure.
Same with
weapons.
The jet fighter program. Where is that? Nowhere.
How can Bombardier build a part of this? Like, can we get Bombardier in there somehow?
So
it's really important.
I point to defense, but then there's just things like pipelines. We can't get pipelines built. It's painful. Absolutely painful. The way we twist ourselves in knots over certain projects, and we've become, in some ways, somewhat balkanized or tribalized in these national projects in terms of trying to move them forward. And I kind of, you look back at previous generations and how the heck did they get it done, right? Like, we can't site C, a dam for that we've been trying to get built here in BC for a number of years, which costs keep going up and up, timeline keeps getting moved to the right. And it's just been this horrible thing to try to get built. Like, same with trying to get bridges built to the lower mainland. All these things, mm-hmm. just painful. We can't get it done. The costs keep going up and up and up. The timeline yeah. keeps moving right and further to the right and further right. And things just become more and more contentious.
And expensive. You're going to yeah. lose out on people being able to, whether it's a pipeline or whether it's a new development of houses. If you know you've got to go through 6 years of red tape and fight and whatever it is and go through hearings to not have a clear understanding of what you need to do to actually get your specs met and get approved, yeah. it's a problem. But yeah. Anyway, we gotta get to our first guest. So I'm really, really excited about this. I had a great conversation. I thought it was really interesting. What did you take away from it? What was your biggest takeaway that our listeners should look out for?
I just think, you know, it's, I think Cabe talks a lot about moral clarity, about us being somewhat, I think, sometimes naive in our approach to foreign affairs, bad actors, and yeah, I don't think I need to go much further into that. Let's let the man speak for himself on the episode. I think it was a great first episode, a great first guest. I'm looking forward to talking to him again in the future. Cause he's got a sharp mind and, I learned a bunch. So yeah.
Perfect. All right. Well, let's get to it. Okay, so Cave Charouz is a lawyer and human rights activist. He's a senior fellow with McDonald Laurier Institute's Center for Advancing Canada's Interests Abroad. He's also a former senior policy advisor on human rights affairs to Global Affairs Canada. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School, and so you know he's smart. And he's written widely on human rights issues and international affairs. He's recently led a successful effort to convince Canada's parliament to recognize the 1988 massacre of political prisoners in Iran as constituting crimes against humanity under international law. And he's based out of Toronto, center of the universe, so you know he will have important things to say on this matter. We're really looking forward to talking to him, so Unbound would like to welcome Cave Charouz. Okay, Cave, you're here. Thank you so much for joining us on Unbound. We're really, really excited to have you here. We think your opinion has been a kind of missing one from the foreign policy conversation in Canada. We've been very focused on China. Obviously, you're kind of an expert on Iran. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you're doing now, what you're thinking about before we kind of get into the issues here?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I understand that I'm one of your first guests, so it's always nice to get on the ground floor. In terms of who I am and what I do, I am a lawyer based in Toronto, so I practice law. That's my day job. I'm also a senior fellow with the McDonald Laurier Institute, and I work on a couple of different things. One on the cultural front, and I think that's maybe outside the scope of this particular conversation, but I'm also involved in their program that focuses on focus on Canada's interests abroad, promoting Canada's interests abroad. And there I work a lot on a variety of human rights issues, but really primarily focused on Iran, which is my country of birth. I moved to Canada when I was about 10 years old. This was shortly after the Iranian Revolution. And I have watched largely in horror as Iran has remained a very closed society, a dictatorship. And it wouldn't be so much, well, I mean, it would be a problem if it was a dictatorship, but I could live with the just regular activism, if Iran was a dictatorship that was seen as such in the West. The problem is that there are segments of the West that I think go to great lengths to justify the behavior of the Iranian regime and to whitewash it. And that's one of the areas of focus for my activism. So I'd be glad to discuss that in further length, but I think there is segments of our population, and these are not obscure people, these are people in positions of power, that think that maybe what's happening in Iran is not so bad and that we ought to just treat them like a normal state. And that's something I fundamentally disagree with.
So maybe then just to kind of kick things off is to kind of explain what the recent news is here, and the timing of you coming on is actually great because of what's happened recently in Syria with Biden, as far as I understand, has attacked a location in Syria related to Iran's support in that country. Could you maybe give us some facts on the ground, and then we can talk about how that situation is being interpreted in the Canadian establishment or in the political establishment here?
Sure. So the facts on the ground, I mean, the most facts with respect to Syria and Iraq and countries like that are a little bit murky, you know, at the best of times. My understanding of the facts is that about a month or so ago, there was an attack on U.S. interest in the U.S. embassy in Iraq by Iranian proxy organizations. Now, Iran basically since 2003 with the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Iran has played more and more of a role in Iraqi politics, and it has a number of military forces, proxy groups that do its bidding, often at the direct behest of the Iranian regime. And they've carried out attacks on American interests repeatedly. You may recall last year at about this time, they carried out an attack that was responded to by the Trump administration by the killing of Qasem Soleimani. The Iranian regime pulled something similar in Iraq, and Biden initially did not react, but then carried out his first foreign military action in Syria, attacking two proxy organizations again that operate at the behest of the Iranian regime. Iran, in that whole region, seems to have a lot of control over Iraq and Syria. It has been a close ally of Bashar Assad, and so it has significant power in Syria. So this was quite a significant attack, possibly. I mean, we'll see how it plays out in the longer term.
So these were essentially, this was an airstrike, not boots on the ground attack on proxy assets of Iran in Syria. So these are groups, correct, I guess, that are funded by, and how do we know that that is the case, that they are, like, is this a long?
Well, I mean, the Iranian regime is not shy about the fact that, it funds and helps various Syrian groups, including the Syrian government. So it's military forces, it's IRGC forces, the special sort of outside force, the part of the IRGC that focuses on operations outside the country, the Quds force. They're actually present in Syria. That's not a secret. I mean, they openly talk about it. And so the fact that these organizations are funded by Iran is widely known.
Okay. And how has this attack been received in the mainstream politics, and then kind of especially with an eye to Canada? It hasn't been that long, and I haven't paid that much attention to it, frankly, like have my eye out for it. Has Trudeau or our federal leaders given any sort of statement in regards to this and how they've interpreted?
I'm embarrassed to say I don't know. I suspect the answer is they haven't, because I haven't seen anything, and I suspect that if they had said something, it would have come across my screen. But to my knowledge, Canada has not taken a position on this. In terms of how it's been received by the mainstream, I mean, increasingly nowadays, I don't know what the mainstream means. People on the right kind of applauded it and said it was a step in the right direction. People on the left said it was, wrong, and why is Biden doing this and, creating war again, even though he had promised not to. So that's it, the reaction roughly broke down along partisan lines.
Is that the way that reactions to foreign interventions, whether they're Iran or otherwise, tend to fall down? In your experience, that there is a strong correlation to right-left in regards to intervention?
Well, yes, but it's complicated. So it depends on who the target is, right? So in cases where the target is an opponent of the United States, I think what you typically find is that, usual right-left breakdown, where the right tends to support the intervention, the left less so. Now, there aren't that many cases where opponents of the United States are attacked, but, cases where at least, somebody takes a harsh line against an ally of the United States, let's say Saudi Arabia or Israel, the breakdown obviously tends to be a little bit different.
Okay. Do you think that, when I think about Canadian foreign policy and just to kind of date myself, I was born in 1987. So kind of my political awakening and awareness kind of started late 1990s, kind of early 2000s. And it seems like it's very much in the zone. And James can speak to this because he's been boots on the ground during some of those years. You know, it's very much rooted in kind of a belief that we're peace brokers, or we're not, we hold ourselves above being an interventionalist nation, and focus on the kind of soft power diplomatic area. Is that kind of the right way to describe how Canadian politicians view themselves, or view our foreign policy?
Sorry, is that a question for me or James?
Well, I want James to, you know, to chime in, because he's got some experience a lot more than I do. I'm doing all the talking and I had the least experience in this room. So, you know, maybe the two of you can kind of hash it out.
No, keep going. Kevin, I'll let you kick it off, and I can
work off. Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the Canadian foreign policy establishment, to the extent that one exists, does think of us as, and in a lot of ways, rightfully, as a middle power, one that can't really flex its muscle militarily too much. So it's got to find other ways. We are obviously protected to a large extent by the power of the U.S. military. But to the extent that we can carve out an independent foreign policy, it's one that's governed largely by diplomacy and trying to get along rather than, you know, flexing of our military muscle. I don't know, James, if that sounds about right to you.
Yeah, that sounds right. Foreign policy is, yeah, it's a little bit messy when it comes to Canada. I can go back to the Lloyd Axe worthy days of the Christian liberals and the soft middle power type diplomacy or actions, and it's a lot through words and not so much through action. And I think sometimes it's very much an appeal to a peacekeeper myth that we hold as a country, and I use that word myth.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you said that. That's actually something I was thinking of in the back of my mind. It's really a myth. I mean, you look at the numbers of our peacekeepers, and it's laughable. Yet somehow we continue to think of ourselves as like the leading peacekeeping nation in the world.
Yeah, and the other thing too, the key thing with peacekeeping is a lot of times, in order to have action that involves a UN sanctioned peacekeeping effort, two entities, at least official state entities, have to agree that they want a peace, and they need support in terms of implementing it. And I would say a lot of what we face globally now is we don't face that situation. And so a lot of times there is some form of state action from an outside entity to try to stop peace, try to stop a conflict. But then that's starting to go down a whole road of international law and discussions. But I do think the peacekeeping myth holds us back or makes us blind a lot to some of the ugliness or hard power aspects beyond our borders.
Yeah. Is that maybe, and I'm asking again as the kind of naive one here, is that maybe because some of the ability for these states to wage a public relations campaign online has been significantly increased? And so while, you know, in the 1990s, if you were, you know, Iran or China, and you wanted to kind of try to control the narrative about what's happening inside your country, you didn't have a great ability to do that because you had to go through a Western press to get the news out. Now they can reach out directly through either the internet or through, I guess, proxies in Canada and the US and Western media. Kaveh, is that something that you see as maybe that one of the changes that's happened that has kind of left our foreign policy approach in the dust?
Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation. I think, these regimes, via China, Iran, Venezuela, whoever, they have figured out how to do an end run around Western media. Not so much an end run, I mean, this is technological advancement. And so they're trying several different things. One is, they've got a very strong online presence, and that can be either real, they've got actual employees of these regimes. They can be artificial through bots. These regimes are increasingly also investing in media operations. You know, like you've got Russia Today. That's a major media source that I see cited all the time online without any skepticism. Iran has its own, it's called Press TV, and it's, you know, geared less so in North America, but it's geared somewhat to Europe, but really mostly to the third world. They keep pumping out their messaging. Other countries, you know, China, it's got its own media ecosystem. So there's that. And then I think one of the other things that countries like China and Iran have done that we have not found a way necessarily to respond to is to get people that are friendly to them in a variety of Western, you know, think tanks, universities, media organizations, and push their narrative that way. And in Canada, I find that we have not been, actually in the United States as well, I don't think we've been particularly good at identifying who these people are and trying to counter their message. And you know, this is something that does not merit a military response. And obviously, like, our military is ill-equipped to deal with that. But I think other organs of our government should be on the lookout for this. And I find that I don't see a lot of people thinking about this issue.
James is nodding his head.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, war by other means. And a lot of times I think when we get to boots on the ground or the sharp end of the sword, that is the very latter end of the spectrum of armed of conflict. I can think of one, I'm trying to think if it was 2000, some 2008, I'll put in notes, there was a document, you can find it online by military leaders within China. It was within their military colleges and all that, that was unrestricted warfare. And it talked about kind of, and by unrestricted warfare, it talked about warfare through many other means. And a lot of times the guns, the bullets, all that was an old aspect to warfare. And yeah, I think, you know, it's increasingly coming up through matters and discussions with related to China, especially Russia. Russia has been a big part of that discussion the last 4 years in terms of information warfare and how they're affecting us via digital means. I think where I'd like to go with this, because I'll loop back to it in terms of my own experience in my community, but I'm going to tell you, you know, we focus a lot on China, especially in the last couple of years, very much a lot of discussion within the Vancouver area with potential of money laundering, foreign capital coming in. Why should we be concerned with Iran as Canadian in the domestic sense, with, you know, our politics, also within our foreign policy? Why does Iran matter?
Well, I think it matters for many of the same reasons that China matters. So I would say Iran is a malevolent international actor. It obviously wreaks havoc in its own region through funding of, you know, a variety of terror groups. But its behavior is not limited to its own backyard. Just about 2 weeks ago, a Belgian court convicted an Iranian diplomat for efforts it had taken, and they were pretty advanced efforts, in blowing up an opposition rally in Paris. You know, potentially hundreds, if not thousands of people would have been killed if the operation had been successful. Turkey arrested, recently detained, I'm not sure exactly how far the case has gone, but they've detained another Iranian diplomat for carrying out a murder of a dissident in Turkey. Iran has a history of killing people outside its borders, dissidents, but it's not just limited to dissidents. It's utter disregard for life, I think, showed itself rather well last year at about this time when it shot down the Ukraine 752 flight and killed a great number of Canadian citizens or Canadian permanent residents. So the evil that Iran does and the disregard it has for human life tends to you know, flow outward and hit us here in Canada. I would note that there have been several Iranian Canadians that have languished in Iranian prison, including one back in 2003, photojournalist named Zahra Kazemi, who was detained and killed by Iranian forces. So all these things really affect Canada and Canadian lives. And on top of all this, you know, there are now reports, you know, CSIS has been talking about this, that Iran has been using information warfare. It's been using disinformation and so on to actually cause some havoc in Canadian politics. So it's been actually trying to target, for example, particular nomination races. So as to pick friendlier candidates influence Canadian politics. And these are all real causes for worry. So there could be mayhem in terms of our politics, and it could be effect on, you know, the life of Canadian citizens, be they Iranian Canadians or Canadians of a different sort. But Iran's long tentacles tend to reach into our borders.
Yeah, and I appreciate that response. And for our listeners, I was feigning ignorance because it's during our last provincial election within my community, Iran came up a number of times. We have a large Iranian community here. And one of the families that was actually a federal liberal member, I think, has been a long time volunteer. They were killed during that shooting down of that aircraft. I think it was January 20th last year. And just with door knocking, it came up to me a couple of times, not that issue particularly, I was surprised, was more what I was expecting in terms of things with China was, and one lady, she talked to me for close to an hour, was about members of the oppressive Iranian regime, basically coming to Canada, living in Canada, having a bunch of money, all this stuff, and not being to live under the radar within the community, even though they were once oppressors of many Iranian Canadians past, so no justice. It was a very passionate discussion. I was on the receiving end.
Oh, absolutely. This is a real concern that people in my community, the Iranian Canadian community, have been talking about for years because we see it with our own eyes. You know, people arriving in Canada with, vast amounts of money, inexplicable amounts of money. Mm-hmm. And they park that money here. Oftentimes, they'll leave their children here and they themselves will go back to Iran to continue to acquire this money through mysterious ways. And we keep bringing it to the attention of the authorities and people just ignore us. There have been two recent reports that I think are significant. One is a story, both stories actually Global News broke, to their credit. They've been pretty good on this. One had to do with a mosque here in Toronto where the CRA has taken the position that, the mosque exists and it gets funding primarily to advertise for and pursue the interests of the Iranian regime here in Canada. These are not my words. This is the CRA's assessment. And that mosque operates, fully in the open, despite what's known about it. Canadian politicians keep going and paying visits to it and shaking hands, almost without regard. And the second story, this was more recent. This was like only a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, where the authorities actually came out and said, look, a lot of these money exchange operations that operate in Toronto are actually a cover for the Iranian regime to funnel money into Canada. Now, where is that money going? Nobody seems to know. We know that money laundering is happening and tons of money is coming in from the Iranian regime into Canada. I don't imagine that money is being put into, mutual funds. I suspect there's more nefarious uses for that money. I assume they have sleeper cells here that are planning bad things. I assume they're trying to influence Canadian politics in a variety of ways. And some of that money is just being used for their own lavish lifestyle. So it's a variety of things and all of it should be of concern to us.
Sorry, just want to back up. So you said that money coming in here that we don't know where it's going and kind of what the purpose is, and we really don't know what its origin is going to towards sleeper cells. So do you mean kind of a physical a terrorist kind of active, or so, do you mean an influence, a group of individuals who are determined to influence the agenda to benefit Iran?
So I note that this is pure speculation.
Yeah,
this is
not, I just want to make sure that that's clear. Yeah, yeah. I don't want to go down the
conspiracy theory rabbit
too quickly.
But
it's really our first guest, so I don't want to get branded right away.
Yeah, just so your listeners know, like I'm not a crazy person. I If I assert something, it's either, you know, fact, or I will actually indicate that it's that I don't know. In this case, I don't know. But if I was the Iranian government, I was bringing tons of money here, and there was a large Iranian diaspora that lived in this country, it would not be crazy to think that some of that money is going towards actual physical sleeper cells that could be activated at certain points. And it's not, you know, this is not fantasy stuff. Iran has this particular regime over its 40-year history has actually had sleeper cells in a variety of countries that have gone out and carried out assassinations, for example. And there was one case back in the early 90s where they did this in Germany, where they went out and actually killed a number of Kurdish dissident activists. And they were, you know, agents of the Iranian government were tried in German courts. And the German courts came out and said, Iran is behind this. And Iran's intelligence minister at the time was actually... is now wanted by Interpol because of his role in that. So it's not, you know, unheard of for them to put those funds towards very, very nefarious and violent means.
So if you were to give advice to the Canadian government, and we're talking federally here, but if you were to give advice to the Canadian government, what steps would you take? I mean, to my mind, making a broader use of the Magnitsky Act, which Canada has passed but not actually used, would be one positive step to challenge what James has talked about, which is basically individuals who have been involved in oppressive actions to not be allowed to kind of live carefree in another country, that their assets would be seized here if that is proven to be the case. That's the only kind of thing that I can think of. And I think we've been too light on not using that, because I think, to my knowledge, yeah, we've passed the act itself, but we haven't put any names onto the list. Mm-hmm. If you could make suggestions other than that, what would they be?
Yeah. So I've been sort of talking about this to any public official that I meet. And I think the suggestions go from the very broad and philosophical to the very detail oriented. And very particular. So by broad philosophical points, I mean that I think we genuinely need to rethink our approach to Iran. We continue, our foreign policy establishment continues to buy into the story, which the Iranian regime loves to put out into the world, that Iran's politics are divided between a bunch of hardliners that hate America and hate the West, and a bunch of reformists who want to fix the country and move us towards democracy. That story is entirely bunk, and yet Western officials all over the world, including Canada, have bought into it. And the reason it's dangerous is because we then end up in this game of, like, how do we empower the reformists and how do we do this and that? But we're losing sight of the fact that, like, there is no, this is all a game. There is no reformist faction in Iran. They're all committed to maintaining, and they're pretty explicit about it. They say this blatantly.
You mean there's no reformists in the political establishment
in Iran? Exactly.
I would guess that there are reformists in the population there, but not. Maybe you can enlighten me on that.
Yeah, I would say that increasingly there are no reformists in the population. I think 20, 30 years ago there was probably a not insignificant size of the population that would have said, you know, we can probably reform this regime so that slowly it becomes a democracy. That project has now failed. It's been ongoing for 25 years. And I think people now recognize that it's not going to go anywhere. So increasingly, I think you see a pretty clear divide in the Iranian population, a very small minority that continues to support this regime, either for ideological reasons or for financial ones, and a much larger part of the population that actually wants this regime gone. Now, we can talk about what it means for that regime to be gone and how it ought to be overthrown. But it's really the within the political establishment that there is still such a thing as a reformist camp. And in the Western world, we continue still to pay lip service to it. And I think it distorts our politics. So what I constantly tell our policymakers is we got to get out of this line of thinking and think about the Iranian regime as one sort of solid entity. Yes, there are factional differences within that regime, but by and large, they have certain ideological commitments. And we ought to recognize that, and we ought to throw our support to the Iranian people that want to be rid of this regime. So that's the big sort of ideological point. In terms of actual sort of detailed policy, so I totally agree with your point. I mean, I think the Magnitsky sanctions, where we target specific people for their crimes, are really important. I think with respect to the Ukraine international flight, we ought to be working with any foreign government that wants to work with us to pursue this investigation and take it to international judicial bodies, the International Court of Justice and elsewhere, to seek justice. There are impediments, there are legal impediments to that. I don't want to downplay them, but that's got to be our approach, and that has not been our approach to date. And I think, you know, if we keep emphasizing this airplane disaster, we're going to get somewhere, because this airplane disaster embodies in it, or includes in it, all the crimes of the regime. It was a blatant attack on civilians. There was an attempted cover-up. There has been no cooperation. The people that are in charge of investigating are actually themselves implicated in, you know, tremendous acts of human rights violations and murder. And so I think that's got to be an area of focus. And the other area of focus is one that we talked about, which is our security forces ought to be keeping an eye, much more so than they've been doing. I mean, I don't know what our security forces are doing, but the fact that these very mysterious people with mysterious sources of money keep arriving in Canada tells me that they're not keeping a very close eye on what's happening. So we ought to be watching these people very carefully, mapping out the network of these people and trying to figure out what they're up to. Regrettably, I don't think much is being done in any of those cases that I just talked about.
So I'm gonna kind of go to James in a second as well, because I think it seems to me, as a non-military guy, without kind of, you know, foreign policy credibility, that Canadian military is kind of totally lost in the woods, because it doesn't know what it wants to be, and it doesn't know what its capacity needs to be to accomplish a foreign policy that it doesn't really have an understanding of what it's trying to do. And would it make more sense to redirect some funds and some financing from the hard military, and buying expensive boats and doing things like that to increase our hard capacity, to dealing with the intelligence aspect, to dealing with kind of the internal threats, the money laundering issues, whether that's Iran or China, influence in our local politicians? Is that kind of, and James, you'd have a better sense of that than me, because it seems to me that unless we're going to put a whole bunch of money into our military to actually make it usable and have some capacity, there's almost no point in having it around to some extent. Not to slam on your career, but let's get into it.
You know, I talk to friends in the military, military commanders, and everyone's kind of fumbling around right now in terms of, and this started back in the late 90s, I'd like to say late 90s, revolution of military affairs in terms of what will the future of warfare look like. I mean, if you look down south, they had, let's not forget, Space Force. I think that's what it's called, Space Force.
Yeah.
And Canada is, we're in a similar place of looking at it, like, you know, information warfare, the cyberspace, special forces, precision. I'm going to probably start trying to adjectives out based on my previous life, but precision-based effects, which is very much the Magnitsky Act, which is something I really like, you know, because we're in a very asymmetric environment right now, based on like social media, international borders. You know, Jeff, you and I even talked about Trudeau's post-nation state and elements of moral relativism, and how that can be quite confusing. And I will poke a finger at, you know, our prime minister, that, you know, maybe the first good step is not shaking hands with the Iranian foreign minister right after a bunch of Canadians are murdered from that regime shooting down our flight. That would be a good
start. That's a big ask. No photo ops is a big ask for this government.
I think moral clarity domestically is going to be an important step. I think what that is, at law, peace, order, let's take our thing back right now, is Canadians, what we stand for is peace, order, and good governance. Well, something like living to the Magnitsky Act and enforcing that is a good first step. And I think when you think, as we discussed the Iranian regime, as we talk about the CCP with China, that, and, you know, elements of Russia, that is probably going to be something increasingly important, where you don't potentially penalize a large monolithic group. You actually act on gangsters. These, and that's what a lot of these leaders and regimes are. They're gangsters. And you act on them and you make it very difficult for them to operate within Canada and within certain cultural and ethnic groups on those certain types of population. Because, you know, these Iranian Canadians are Canadians and they need the protection from these foreign actors that go into these communities, potentially go in these communities and intimidate them in terms of a, you know, political lobby groups. So I think that's the first step. The next thing, we talk about cyber and all that. That's like a long discussion, but that's, I think, where we first need to go.
Yeah. Can I jump in with something? Because I think you're absolutely right. This idea of moral clarity is so central, but I think it brings us back to the earlier conversation about how these nefarious regimes like China and Iran and Russia, how they operate. And I think one of the things they've been doing, either, you know, via places like Twitter or their own, you know, media operations, is to muddy the waters on these moral issues, right? So that if you are a young Canadian, you know, you're getting news from a bunch of sources, some of which is probably behind the scenes financed by, you know, these bad regimes, telling you that what Iran does is not fundamentally different than what the United States does or what Canada does or what have you. These are all roughly the same. And that's a message that you're hearing. And as a young sort of idealistic person, chances are you're probably susceptible to that messaging. And so unfortunately that tends to filter into our political class. And they buy into it. And of course they buy into it, and it's helped by the fact, as other things that we mentioned, there's a ton of money coming into this country. They want to keep, you know, they want to keep the money coming in because those investments matter. And those, that money that's coming in is sometimes coming into their campaigns, and they want to keep those people happy. They want to keep their contributors happy. I think all of it kind of ties together. So there's all sorts of incentives to be morally confused.
I think,
and it's incumbent upon people like us to keep driving home this very simple message that a regime that shoots a plane full of civilians out of the sky cannot be a morally good actor. Like you just cannot be confused about that.
I think that's a good point. And I think that the other thing I'd say that the real benefit is that it prevents politicians from having to make tough decisions. It allows them to sit on the fence. And I don't think there was a better encapsulation of that. I saw a clip today, I think it was from today, of an MSNBC interview with Justin Trudeau on selling weapons to Saudi, now that there's a public document out there on Jamal Khashoggi and MSB in Saudi Arabia being the one who authorized his assassination. And it was basically a line of Justin Trudeau saying, well, we always, you know, are people who condemn human rights abuses, and we want to work to, you know, to fight them. And we'll always kind of bring that up in conversations. And then he was pushed to kind of say, so are you going to continue selling weapons? He said, well, we're going to continue working with our allies. And they said, so is Saudi Arabia your ally? And he's like, well, I guess I wouldn't call them our ally. And it's just like, you just are allowed to continually like run on the treadmill to the next moral position that fits the conversation that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, when it comes to China, which is kind of a clearer example, if you wanted to take a strong stand against the genocide that's happening there, which I think reasonable people agree is what's happening, that means telling Canadians that their electronics and their consumer goods are going to get more expensive. That's a tough sell. I mean, politically, that's what it comes down to. And I don't think that's right. But I think that it really will take some fearless leaders to say, I need to take a strong stand against this. And that's when, and actually I want to ask you about this, because this I do have a little bit of experience in. I, growing up in Alberta, was always under the assumption that the reason why Saudi Arabia especially derived a lot of its international political power was through its ability to export oil and to control the oil markets. With the US now being able to produce so much more oil and everybody being less reliant on Middle Eastern oil, I thought that it would have been easier to isolate states like Iran and Saudi Arabia from doing bad things, but that doesn't seem to have happened. Am I just totally misguided in what I believe might be the case? Or is this something that Iran and Saudi and, you know, the other actors there have kind of manufactured a way to continue their influence after that?
That's a great question, and I have no unique expertise on oil politics. I suspect that part of it is just because there's a huge market outside of the United States and Canada for oil, right?
Yeah.
China is now an increasingly large market for Iranian, Saudi, whatever oil. That's part of it. Part of the reason why we can't keep Saudi Arabia in check very well is because it's not just important for its oil sales, it's also important as a check on Iranian power. Right. So I think a lot of Western politicians have been willing to coddle the Saudi royal family because of other reasons other than
convenience oil. Of having an ally in the Middle East.
Exactly. I suspect that's a big part of it.
Yeah, other than Israel, because it's nice to have, because the problem is that Israel is a polarizing issue in the Middle East itself.
Exactly.
So you need a non-Israel state there to be your ally. Okay, that makes more sense to me. Thanks. Okay, so we're almost reaching the end of our hour here. A last thing I want to kind of ask about is why Canadians don't care about foreign policy. We talked a lot of the talk in the U.S. around Trump was about his foreign policy, about how, you know, he wasn't going to put us into any more wars. And, you know, he did that. And people have kind of cited that as one of his maybe the only success that he had in a positive contribution to the world. Canadians, we just don't really ever talk about foreign policy issues when it comes to politics. Maybe that's a bit because of the pandemic and because of everything else going on. But is there a way that we can raise the awareness of how important that issue is in our politics?
That's a great question. I don't know if I've got a good answer to it. I will say that I totally agree with your premise. I just published a piece about the Uyghur genocide, and I beat up on Justin Trudeau for it. But I concluded on a very sad note, which is that, you know, all this stuff just doesn't matter. He can cast the vote however he wants, and Canadians will not care. And that's the truth. Foreign policy does not move voters one way or the other in any significant number.
And that was an excellent article that I will link, because the line is excellent and your article was very, very good. I will make sure that we link that, because it's really worth reading if you're interested in
that's very kind of you. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe we can devote a minute to talk about how Justin Trudeau is morally very confused on this issue, but to the general point, yes, foreign policy does not move voters. But I think the answer, if there is one, is something that James said earlier, which was, how do you make people realize that Iran's bad actions or China's bad actions actually affect us here in Canada? And I think that's really the key, is to not think of it as foreign affairs, but to think of it as domestic affairs. This actually has an impact. What China does has an impact on our, you know, when they come and buy up our oil companies, for example, when they make these investments, this actually has significant ramifications for the Canadian economy. Right. If they're getting the 5G contract,
Huawei network,
Huawei, yeah. I mean, that actually has an effect on your day-to-day telecommunications abilities. When you have deals with China for them, when you trust China, for example, to tell the truth about diseases, and they don't, well, guess what? You end up in lockdown for a year. So these are not sort of abstract foreign affairs concepts. These are issues that affect your day-to-day life. I think if we can frame the debate that way, hopefully, maybe, possibly, we'll begin to see a shift, but I don't know. That's a mystery. That's always been a mystery to me. Yeah.
And you mentioned you would like, you know, you're always happy to talk for a minute about Justin Trudeau's confused morality. So I'm more than happy to give you a minute for that. I can give you as much time as you need. Yeah. So let's hear it.
No, that's maybe it sets us up to talk about something that I know is important to you guys, which is like the realignment around politics. So I say this as somebody who in 2014 was a member of the Liberal Party and enough of a believer in it to have sought the nomination of the Liberal Party under Justin Trudeau. It is 2021 when we record this, and I am utterly, to some extent, baffled and confused by the positions that he's taken, but also utterly disgusted by many of the foreign policy positions that Justin Trudeau has taken. And mm-hmm. I find that I no longer have a home in the Liberal Party. Mm-hmm. I think that realignment is happening where, you know, somebody with my politics, somebody who really deeply believes in human rights, somebody who believes in the ability of democratic states, and not just their ability, but also the obligation of free states across the world to work together to bring democracy and human rights to parts of the world that don't have it. The fact that somebody like me no longer has a home in the Liberal Party, I think should tell you something about how the ground has shifted. I mean, that was always the talking point of what the Liberal Party was about. And I think you were telling me before we started recording that you're viewing this from a center, you're viewing the issues that you talk about on this podcast from a center-right lens. And you're interested in talking about realignment, well, that's the realignment that's happening, is that I find that the Conservative Party, for example, even though I try to be as nonpartisan as possible, the Conservative Party in Canada in 2021 is talking a lot more forcefully on issues of human rights than any of the other parties to the left of it. So anyway, that was not quite the beating up on Justin Trudeau, but I think it probably ties into the thesis statement of your podcast here.
Yeah, James and I think are in the same boat. I think I was a last podcast, last discussion we had, I talked about how I'm all dressed up and just waiting for somebody else to take me to the dance kind of thing, because I know that I have voted Justin Trudeau. I think I voted in 2017 or 2018, not the last election, but the one before that, I voted Liberal. But you know, there's nothing there. It just feels like it's an empty vessel to fill whatever is popular at the time and convenient, and dress it up really nice, but doesn't have a huge amount of certainty behind it and conviction behind the values that it holds. Mm-hmm. James?
I think you guys have said it all. I'm processing what you're saying, and I always kind of, I'm thinking about political backrooms of what we're discussing and going, okay, well, how is that attractive to soccer moms? Because there's always this imaginary person, the soccer mom that political parties have to, the suburban soccer mom that parties have to focus their message on to attract and to get that vote. Suburban soccer moms affect the political opinions of families and their husbands, et cetera, et cetera. It's this imaginary figure I'm always being told about. And so right now it's three men discussing this, having this discussion, and that's good. I've had this discussion with my mom a number of times. She's been a federal liberal a long time. She feels completely abandoned by Trudeau. She's very morally clear, and I think she's a little bit more attuned to foreign policy just based on her two sons coming from a military background and getting involved in the military. But there's a lot of Canadians that don't have that connection to anything with foreign policy, because, you know, the family's not in the military or we're not involved in foreign service and all that. So I'm pondering. I don't have the answer. I'm wondering if either one of you can answer that.
Well, maybe it's kind of what Kaveh said earlier. It's about kind of humanizing it on a domestic level of saying, you know, maybe if the Conservative Party would kind of take the multiculturalism thing that the Liberals have held so long and say, this is something that's great and we're really proud of it. But along with that means that we've got communities of people, whether they're Iranian or Chinese or Uyghur, who are still facing persecution from their home nation, even though they're within our borders and they're our neighbors and their kids go to our schools. That may be a way to connect those dots to make them more relevant. And I could buy that narrative, maybe.
On that point, I will say that this tends to be a bipartisan problem. So part of the reason why we lack this moral clarity on Iran, I know this because I've observed it up close, is that our politicians are getting mixed messages about who the good guys and bad guys are in Iran.
Yeah.
Part of the reason why they're getting that mixed message is for 10 or 15 years, Canada changed its immigration policy so that it wasn't just allowing in, you know, dissidents or refugees or people that really needed to come here or people that were deserving of coming to Canada. Both Liberals and Conservatives changed the rules so that we privileged the investor class, right?
Right.
And so people with huge sums of money from China, Iran, Russia, whatever, they ended up in this country, you know, using the rules that we had set up. And, you know, which politician wants to go on the record and say, no, we ought to keep investors out. And those people came here with their ties to these regimes, with their money, and they began to sort of cause that moral confusion that we talked about. And I think really one of the first steps is for somebody to stand up and say, look, our immigration rules just need to change. Like, yes, we want capital to come here, but we can't just suspend all our rules and suspend our morality in order to attract capital. There's got to be some rules around this.
That's not helped by this weird Canadianism of Quebec having its own immigration system.
Yeah.
Like, no, I mean, and I don't understand how, you know, I wasn't around when the discussions were happening about essentially two parallel immigration systems into a country. One of them is run by provincial government, but that's a very unique Canadian thing. I don't see how you resolve that without getting the Quebec government simultaneously to do that. And if the issue is a matter of bringing people in and paying a deposit or a loan or some sort of cash payment to the country or the province, it's a prisoner's dilemma game a little bit between the two. So yeah,
absolutely. I always get you know, I agree with what's being said here. There's always that fear too, as a center-right party, a Canadian Conservative Party, starts going towards anything with immigration, that quickly comes with labels, and you get put into a box very quickly, and then you're fighting your entire campaign trying to get out of that box, whether fair or unfair. It's the nature of the game, and so it's,
is that something difficult. You have experience with, James?
I mean, like, you know, experienced conservatives that I, you know, rub shoulders with occasionally, they're much more gristled and hardened, and they're just like, ah, you just got to go for it. You're going to come with that label. And that was, yeah, we're going to have a conversation with this woman later, Jennifer Sanford, who's also doing her podcast series, Conservative Like Me, which is based on this thing of this fear that people have, where they kind of look over both shoulders and quickly whisper to someone, I'm a conservative, because of the labels that come with it. And people are scared to kind of say, yeah, you know what, this is what I have. That might be different within rural Canada, but in urban areas, you definitely feel that. And I'm also thinking of, you know, and I hope we get that discussion or guest as well, is Ben Woodfin, where he talks about a patriotic viewpoint or discussion for a conservative element. What will that look like in the future, and how do we roll that in? And this, again, it kind of goes back to that versus that post-nation state, which Trudeau has clearly labeled himself with, versus we as a conservative center, we believe in the nation, we believe we're this, that, this is what we stand for, and we reduce that ambiguity. We're probably having an election this spring. I don't know if we have the time for it. This might be a longer project, but I think it's something that we have to go towards, right?
Yeah.
I think it's made a lot easier. Sorry, Kavai, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think what you hinted at is absolutely right. I mean, I think once you start talking about immigration, the discussion does tend to get a little bit distorted sometimes, and a lot of name calling. And rightfully, you know, there are people that use the immigration debate as a cover for sort of race, for their racism.
Yes, you know, and that's a problem on the right. That is a problem on the right,
and we ought to acknowledge that. But yep. Not all discussion about immigration is a cover for racism. Some of it is legitimately a conversation about immigration. And I think the solution to that is for the conservatives to employ people from these communities that can make these points much more credibly, right? So if you have a Chinese dissident, for example, saying, look, we've got a real problem here, an Iranian dissident making that argument, I think it will be hard to dismiss those as merely just xenophobia. Hopefully Canadians will hear that message.
And I think I was going to say as well, I think that that is totally true. And also, if you have political leaders, I think Michael Chong is the one who comes to mind the most, who are very outspoken in their defense of human rights and the promotion of, you know, those values in a non-apologetic way. I think it makes it a lot easier for the average, you know, person to turn around and say, yeah, I have no problem saying I'm backing that vision. Right, there's a vision there that I can see, and I believe that they are have conviction in it, and I support it. I think the problem is right now is when I say that the federal Liberals are an empty, you know, vessel to be filled with whatever. It's basically the same story for the Conservative, except the what you're filling it with is, you know, a little bit more right wing stuff, and then a bit of the crazy stuff on the fringe, and that's the stuff that kind of everybody sees. So that stuff has got to be excised, but having something concrete, a concrete set of moral values that you can point to and say, and reliably say that if Canada is faced by a situation like we see with the Uyghurs or what we see with dissidents from Iran being harassed in Canada, that they will take a stand on that. that actually is something that I think I could see people, you know, getting behind. I don't see it right now in our politics, but I'd hope that it maybe shows up. Please.
I agree with you.
Okay. Well, we're at the end of our time. Kaveh, it's been great having you. Is there anything else we missed that you want to talk about? Do you want to do a plug for yourself, McDonald Laurier? You know,
I've got nothing to plug. On Twitter, people usually plug their SoundClouds or whatever. I got no SoundClouds. I don't rap. I don't rap on.
You're the not a SoundCloud rapper? But, not yet.
Yeah, no, not yet. Exactly. A boy can dream. Yeah. But yeah, McDonald Laurier Institute does fantastic work on foreign policy, which is what I'm involved with, but also just domestic matters, cultural matters. Do check them out. And I'm at @kcharouz on Twitter, where I'm fighting with people constantly.
Perfect. We'll make sure we plug that, and we'll be happy to touch base again in a couple weeks or couple months and kind of continue this conversation, especially as the situation develops with what's going on right now with Biden and Syria. Okay.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Kaveh.
Thanks, guys.
Okay. That James looks like he's frozen. James, are you still here? I'm going to end
frozen.
It. Yeah, right, you were frozen there for a bit. We ended the podcast. I don't know if you were here for it.
No, I heard everything. I'm good.
Okay, that was a great conversation. I really, really enjoyed that, Kaveh.
I really enjoyed it too. I hope it works out. I hope the final product is good. Let me know when it's up and I'll listen to it.
Yeah, so our tentative plan is we like I said, we haven't done any promotion yet. James, I got to talk to you. Ben Woodfin does want to talk to us, so that's kind of another one we can have in the tank.
Oh, he's great. I love him. Yeah,
and we're... my plan right now is to have this come out on Thursday this week. If it doesn't come out this Thursday, it'll come out next Thursday, but I think we're going to try to get it out this Thursday. We'll have a Twitter handle for the podcast, and if you we'll link you to it. And then if you could just kind of retweet us back, because that's how we're going to kind of generate our subscribership. Right now, our numbers say we have like 6 subscribers, because it's really just James and I and our significant others. But hopefully we'll be able to grow it pretty quickly with some people like you who've got some followings and stuff like that.
That sounds awesome. We'd love to.
Yeah. Okay.
This is Jess here for a second, Kaveh. You said something about courage and service. I think what you do, your voice in terms of human rights is courageous. And we need more people like you to speak up and all that. Because I know that does come a lot of times through or against intimidation and against the grain of what people would like to discuss. So please keep doing what you're doing.
Fantastic. Yeah, I 100% agree with that.
You're both very kind. Thank you guys so much.
Okay, thank you so much, guys. Take care.
Have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to Unbound. If you enjoyed our conversation, the best way you could help us continue it is to give us a like and a 5-star review wherever you get podcasts. It'd go a long way to help us grow our user base and include more and more people in our conversation. See you next time.